Hello and welcome everybody to the next lecture of lecture of Architectures of Supercomputers. Today we will be talking about multi-core CPUs, and I'm not sure how far we get, but if we get far enough, we'll also talk about the roofline model, which should remind you of the previous exercises. So, when I was studying, it was actually the time of transition between single-core systems and multi-core systems. You could now question, why do we even have multi-core systems? And actually, the reason for this is physics. It's manufacturing processes. What you can see here is actually an older slide. Give me a second. I'll briefly update my slides. Okay, so what you can see now is the slide is pretty much the same. I just took out some bullet points. The reason why I did this is the slide before this contained some hints on the limits of Moore's law. Basically, what is Moore's law? It's actually not a law in a sense like a physical law, a law of physics, a law of nature, but it's more a statistical observation, namely, that the availability, the number of transistors on a densely packed integrated circuit doubles about every 24 months. Often you will read 18 months. This is because one of the managers of Intel was quoted with 18 months. But I think the statistical data is more to, and confers more to 24 months. So what you can see here are the transistors per die. This is an exponential axis, of course, because the law says it's doubling. And you can see here data from the 1960s up to the early 2000 years. And that's a pretty good match for this. Still, it's hard to imagine that this law will continue indefinitely, right? Because we cannot shrink structures on the die below atomic sizes. So there is the assumption that Moore's law will someday come to hold. We don't know when. As you know, last week I've been to the supercomputing conference, and I did learn a new law there, which says that the number of people who proclaim the end of Moore's law doubles every 18 months. So. I don't want to say when Moore's law will end, but for now it is something we can rely on, at least for the next years. Let's see. Okay, so this is a different diagram. I took this from an article on the IEEE website. Reading this is actually highly recommended, so if you got some spare time, I can only recommend reading this. And does anyone know the current manufacturing process Intel is using for the Broadwell CPUs? I'm hearing some numbers.
14 nanometers.
Yes, exactly, 14 nanometers. So that would, actually we are here, this article is from 2013, so 2014, it predicts we'd be using 14 nanometers, which is actually correct. So. The red curve here is the node name. Node name in this context means the nanometer size of the process. Now the question is, what does this mean at all? Actually, this node name is just basically today a marketing name. It does not necessarily mean that structures on our integrated circuit actually have this size. So I used to think that 14 nanometers means my whole transistor is 14 nanometers in size, which it actually isn't. So here are two other curves, namely the orange curve is 1/2 pitch. This means this is the distance between two wires. or at actually half the distance between two wires on the first layer of the integrated circuit where wires are really densely packed. Does anyone know why we might not be able to decrease this pitch? Because of electron tunneling. If you put wires too close together, electrons might tunnel from one to another. And also because of capacity effects. So if you put wires really closely together, they might act as a capacitor. That's another problem. And yellow is the gate length. What you can see here is actually through the past years, the gate length did decrease, but not dramatically. So one problem we currently have is we, by the way, do you know what a gate is in a transistor? So I think the CE, computational engineering students, should know what this means. If we imagine a CMOS transistor, or to be more exact, it's already a MOS transistor, we usually have some part of silicon, which we call bulk. We have a source, and drain, and sitting on top of that, isolated from the bulk, and actually also isolated from drain and source, is the gate. Now, depending on if you have a P or an N channel transistor, the way how the materials are dotieren. What is dotieren in English? Usually I think that I'm pretty good in English, at least for computer science subjects. But every now and then I realize that some words are missing. Sorry?
Dope.
Dope? Okay, that doesn't sound right. Okay, so depending on which type of transistor I have, these materials are differently doped. The role of the gate is really to inverse the way the bulk is doped. So basically it will create a conductive channel between source and drain. And the reason why this gate length cannot decrease is if we put source and drain too closely together, electrons will simply hop over. So what we can deduce from this is, the gate length is still shrinking, but not much. So I perhaps cannot expect much more transistors on a die. And also one other interesting thing here is really to remember that the node name, the processing method, does not necessarily tell us how large features of the transistors on a chip are. So, however, in the past, we were in a pretty lucky, or should I say nice situation because shrinking transistor sizes meant that we would get higher clock speeds. Smaller transistors simply means that the time required for signals to pass through transistors was lower if we increased density. Smaller transistors also meant we could build more complex architectures because our transistor budget was suddenly larger. And also, because we are using smaller transistors, we could reduce voltage. This reduced power consumption, and overall, could decrease power consumption or heat consumption in the whole chip. This is somewhat changing. We know technology will advance. We already have billions of transistors. Do you know roughly how many transistors are in a current NVIDIA GPU? About 7 billion. transistors. This is actually, I still remember the time when Intel published one of their Itanium CPUs, and for Itanium it was new to pass the magical barrier of 1 billion transistors, and people said, no one really needs 1 billion transistors. Now here we are with 7 billion transistors. I'm pretty sure people will always find a way to make use of even more transistors. So the limit we are currently hitting, which we might hit in the future, are atomic dimensions. Do you know the pitch of silicon atoms in crystal? I did some research. I'm hoping that I'm quoting the correct numbers, but it's about 0.5 nanometers, a bit more. So even if we assume that Moore's law will still hold true, that means that in a couple of iterations, we will arrive at, so let's assume we will continue with the current die shrinks, which means we will move from 14 nanometers, and we are always dividing this by a square root of 2. This would mean that we'll move on to 10 nanometers. I think the next stop should be 7. Okay. So if you're doing the computing for me, that's easier for me. So what would come after 7?
5.
I'm not sure how much further this would make sense, but you can see that somewhere when the transistor would be represented by a single atom, we probably cannot continue with current technology. So I'm not sure what would come after this, but yeah, let's see. We will find out. Another problem, actually, this is a more pressing problem which people did not anticipate until a couple of years ago, because back then, when we shrunk transistors, this always meant that the per transistor power consumption would also be reduced. But for current CPUs, this is no longer the case. We are shrinking transistors, but still the power consumption per transistor does not shrink as fast as their size shrinks. So what we are having now is a problem called dark silicon. This means I have maybe 7 billion transistors, but I cannot let them all fire simultaneously. I can only use parts of those. So I have to figure out a way, or I have to think about my architectures and structure them in a way so that I can always use those parts of the chip which are most beneficial to me. Actually, one result of this is if I'm buying a current Intel CPU, it will say, okay, you can run with a certain clock speed if you're using all cores simultaneously. But if you're using just one core or just parts of the chip, you may be allowed to clock it higher, which is called boost mode. So this is a positive way of representing it. You could also say the CPU is clocked at not 2 gigahertz, but 3.5 gigahertz, and it's being clocked lower if you're using all cores. So there's a certain heat penalty for using too much of the chip simultaneously. Actually, there's one other problem with the new Intel designs. You're probably aware that the most recent server chip from Intel is the, was it? Ivy Bridge EP? No, Haswell EP. Haswell, one of the major architecture advancement of Haswell was that this chip supports fused multiply add. So one pipeline can do, in a single step, this calculation. I'm sure it might be on Intel that one of the source operands also has to be the same as a target operand. But basically, it can do in one pipeline can deliver per cycle the result of a multiplication and an addition. Previously, we only had pipelines which could do either the multiplication or the addition. So if you're looking at certain benchmarks, for instance, the Linpack benchmark, this essentially doubles the performance of a chip, this small change. The problem is these computations generate more heat. They use more power. So the result is, if you're using this fused multiply add on a recent Intel chip, it will actually clock lower. You will get a performance penalty because this is generating too much heat. And so the chip will decide, OK, we are now clocking even slower than the base clock, at least for 1 millisecond. And 1 millisecond is huge for chips. That's like 2 million clock cycles. That's simply, that's quite a lot. So the result of this downclocking is, for current chips, that some people even say, oh, we are not using fused multiply add at all because we want to avoid this clock penalty. It really depends. But what I'm trying to say with this is dark silicon is a huge problem, and it will get even worse for the future. OK, another way to look at this is we are now comparing the performance in millions of operations per second. I'm sorry, this chart is in German. And we are comparing this to the time. And there are actually two reasons why the performance is growing. One is pure clock speed. This has stagnated, right? If we would continue this graph beyond 2004, this would almost be a flat line. It's not growing too fast. And the other source for performance increments is architectural improvements. So in the 1980s, we had pipelines, integrated cache controllers in the 90s, multiple issue also in the 90s, speculative and out-of-order execution, vectorization, movement of caches into the CPU, hyperthreading. The problem with these architectural improvements is most of them try to either extract more parallelism from a single instruction stream, or they aim to improve data movement. And in the past years, we haven't seen much improvements on these areas. So even though new microarchitectures are more efficient, have wider data paths, have more pipelines, they probably don't yield as much benefit as they used to a couple of years ago. OK, another problem is for increasing clock speeds that we are getting into different difficult territory for power consumption. What we can say is, for a certain chip size, we cannot dissipate more than a certain limit of power. So here, also a couple of older CPU lines have been plotted. And what you can see is that a couple of years ago, the Pentium, Pentium Pro, Pentium 2, Pentium 3, they all were in a very they all had a very low power consumption compared to modern CPUs. What happened with the Pentium 4? It was the first line of Intel which aggressively increased clock speeds, basically to combat with current AMD CPUs. But the problem of the Pentium 4 was it did suppress certain thermal limits. So back then, suddenly people realized they had to install larger fans on their CPUs. And if the fan was not large enough, if the heat sink was not large enough, the CPU might actually be damaged. Today, if you buy a server chip, I think the maximum power dissipation of Intel CPUs is around 135 watts, not much more. So this hasn't changed in the past 10 years. We could get rid of more heat by water cooling, but it's not a lot that we could gain. So maybe we could increase power consumption by a factor of two, but as I said, there is a certain limit which we probably won't be able to surpass. And going even beyond that increases the risk for the hardware, because if cooling fails for a certain, even for a short amount of time, the hardware might be damaged. Okay, so why are we moving to multi-core architectures? Well, this is the power or heat dissipation. And what you can see here is it depends on the clock frequency and the voltage, actually the square of the voltage. The problem is if we are increasing frequencies, we have also to increase the voltage. So in total, power dissipation grows not just linearly with the clock frequency. Okay, so the benefit of multiple cores is we can lower the frequency, we can use less die space, and the hope is that the performance will grow linearly with the number of cores. So this is one of the reasons why we now have multi-cores. Now the question is, how will these multi-cores look like in the future? Currently we already see two different trends. One is, one which you can see for Intel designs is homogeneous designs where every core is the same. Actually this is not perhaps not that true any longer, because modern Intel designs are changing, and we can see some heterogeneous designs. IBM's cell processor, which is now out of production, but it was an interesting design when it came out. NVIDIA doesn't yet have heterogeneous designs. Only if you combine an NVIDIA GPU with an Intel CPU, you could say, okay, this is a heterogeneous design. But if you just look at NVIDIA's designs themselves, they are mostly homogeneous. But future NVIDIA designs might be heterogeneous, because they might try to combine ARM CPUs and their own graphics cores. Similar speaking, you could say that if you buy a modern Intel notebook CPU, this is in a certain sense a heterogeneous design, because you have normal x86 cores and you have graphics cores on them, which can at least to a certain degree be programmed via OpenCL. So it's often a way of interpreting the architecture to say, to tell if it's homogeneous or heterogeneous. What we can say is that on the horizon, actually on the horizon is true since 2010, so this hasn't changed much in the past years, is that we'll get more cores and even oddly numbered cores. So on the student cluster competition where I've been last week, some teams had CPUs with 18 cores. Our team had CPUs with 14 and 12 cores. That's probably not the number you would have assumed back then when we only had dual cores and quad cores. So actually, what we'll probably see are those tiled cores where we have some number of cores times some other number of cores. I think the only thing we can say is that predicting the future is very hard, and probably I shouldn't do it anyway. Okay. The interesting thing is, sometimes if you look at very old slides, you can see how wrong they are. So this was a prediction which tried to estimate how many processors we would have on a chip by 2015. So I'm pretty confident that we won't have 100 billion transistors next year. And also, especially not that we'll be using more than 90% just for the cache. That won't be happening. But perhaps 10 billion. We are currently at 7 billion, so I think a good upper limit is 10 billion transistors. But as I said, it doesn't really matter. Pollack's rule says if we double the number of transistors in a single core, then we would get about 50% more performance. The reason is if we increase the number of transistors, we can probably increase the degree of out-of-order execution. We can probably increase the size of caches. We can do more vectorization. But ultimately, my performance won't really grow linearly with the number of compute units in a single core. For that, I would probably need to add more cores. Again, Pollock's rule is not really a law of nature, but it's more an observation based on previous architectures. Okay. So this, as I said, is more an observation. So if you plot different architectures, you can probably arrive at such a degree. I hope the original paper did not use just 5 data points. High-performance computing is really obsessed with trying to predict the future. So last week, I did attend a session where they presented the current results of the top 500 list. Did I tell you what the top 500 list is? Okay. So the problem of the top 500 list is currently at the top 10, there's not much new happening. So I think over the last three lists, the top 10 did not change much. Perhaps one new addition, but not more. One reason for this is that those systems are getting much more expensive, and few states can afford to build such a system, because usually to get into the top 10, you need to pay more than $100 million for your system alone, and probably twice of that, twice as much for power consumption through the next 3 to 5 years. So those systems are really expensive. Still, people tried to do data mining on those systems. And if you have just 5 data points, you can derive at all sorts of interesting conclusions. So if you want to see some interesting data mining, please look at the recording of the last top 500 presentation. I wouldn't want to watch this with a statistician next to me. Okay, so. As we said before, doubling the processor count in a single core will yield me only 50% increase. But if I can go from single core to dual core, perhaps my performance will increase by 70 to 80%. This is, of course, just a random guess. It really depends on your software and the problem at hand. For some codes, my performance won't grow at all, because some codes simply don't scale to multiple threads. On the other hand, some codes will scale perfectly. For those, I will get exactly twice the performance for two cores. So it's really hard to say. So there are a couple of other benefits for multi-core CPUs. So for instance, if I'm not using a couple of cores, I can simply switch them off. I can operate single cores. I can modulate the power on single cores, so I can optimize those power consumptions. Also, my power consumption and my heat dissipation will be more evenly spread out through the cores or through the die space. So one further benefit is that I don't get as much pronounced hotspots as for single cores. I think we'll skip through these slides because we had too many predictions of the future. Okay. So if I inversely apply Pollock's rule, I can say with more cores, I get perhaps more performance, again, depending on the code. So if I have 1 billion transistors, I could have 10 cores with 100 million transistors, or 100 cores or 1,000 cores with 1 million transistors. It always depends which design is best. I'm pretty sure that 1,000 cores is perhaps overdoing this a bit. But actually, this is one route which GPUs went down. They took really, really simple cores with just a few transistors per core. Okay. One problem we are currently running into is the network on chip. So for at least for the previous generation of Intel CPUs, we always had a ring bus, which did connect all cores. One thing which is now new for the new Haswell EP processors is that they now have two ring buses. So if these are, let's say this is a 6-core design, the CPUs always had a ring bus which would connect the individual cores and the memory controller. The interesting thing here is a single core did contain, or still does contain, the core itself, level 1 and data and level 1 instruction caches, level 2 cache, and a partition of the level 3 cache. Which is interesting because to the CPUs, it looks like there was just one global level 3 cache. But actually, it's split up and stored per core. And if you take a look at Intel data sheets, you can see that the size of the level 3 cache grows with the number of cores. It's pretty much constant if you divide the size by the number of cores. Now, what's happening for Haswell EP is they did not increase the size of the ring bus, but instead they said, okay, let's have multiple ring buses and connect them. The size of these ring buses depends on the total number of cores on a chip. But it is also pretty obvious that this setup won't scale beyond a certain number of chips, of cores. So for the next iteration of the Xeon Phi processor, we'll probably see such a mesh network. Okay, who of you knows Amdahl's law? Okay, so not everyone. Basically, Amdahl's law is the parallel speedup is 1 divided by the sequential fraction plus 1 minus sequential fraction divided by n. And n is the number of processors, which means the parallel speedup is essentially limited by the serial fraction, because this term here, if you let n grow, is basically 0. But this term here is constant. So one problem for multicores is, depending on the serial fraction of a code, we might not get a satisfying speedup. Okay. As I said before, one benefit of multicores is that we can control power on a much more fine-grained scale. So some cores could run at full frequency, some could be switched off, some could be running at just half the frequency we need. Okay. So if we consider that we will probably get more and more cores on chip and these ring buses won't be fast enough, what could we do? It's pretty likely that all new CPUs will feature some kind of on-chip network. The question is just how well will this be hidden from the programmer, or will it be hidden at all? So if you how many of you have ever seen a die plot of the IBM Cell CPU? Okay, that's good. So we'll take a look at this in the next lecture. The problem of the Cell CPU was, the benefit of the Cell CPU was it had multiple vector units, and those vector units were connected via a ring bus, and this was very efficient. But the problem was the programmer had to care for all data movement, which made it complicated, and only few programmers were capable of exploiting this. If you take a look at Intel's designs, these ring buses here are completely transparent to the user. You can discover those by micro benchmarks, but usually your code can just run and ignore those ring buses and assume all cores are connected via a crossbar. It will perform slightly different, but still very efficient. If we have on-chip networks, let's say mesh networks, where cores here are always connected to their next neighbors, this will probably change. I'm not sure how well this can work if you don't expose this to the programmer, because usually you would expect that the programmer could then pass data to neighboring nodes and know which data path can be used. Because otherwise, if you don't tell the programmer, for instance, these links here are pretty likely to be overrun because all processes need to access data from the memory controller. I'm not sure. We will see. Okay, so first part of the lecture is already done, actually. That was good. For the exercises, you had to do some basic performance estimate. You should try to figure out how fast can my code run based on machine properties and properties of the code. Actually, this is a problem everyone has in high-performance computing. Usually, you want to figure out how fast can my code run at all. So one simple way of modeling this is the roofline model. The problem is current machines are really complicated. So we have caches, we have pipeline ALUs, we have superscalar pipelines. Most of them have branch prediction and out-of-order execution. I put this in brackets because some current designs don't have them. For instance, Intel's Xeon Phi doesn't have out-of-order execution. And as far as I know, also, it does not have branch prediction. Pretty much every design has multiple cores. And so the complexity of these designs is simply so large that it's easy to be overwhelmed by it. So there's a huge desire to reduce this complexity, at least for certain performance estimates. And this is actually what the roofline model gives us. It doesn't have to be perfect. So it's really just an estimate, but it should be easily applicable to most problems. Actually, the roofline model has another problem, namely sometimes codes are difficult to assess. So sometimes you can't just look at a program and see how many floating point calculations it does. And also, it's, of course, only applicable if your code does a lot of floating point operations. If your code is heavy on branches or integer arithmetic, it's much more difficult to apply. If it's really just doing integer arithmetics, you could alter the roofline model to encompass that. But if it's branch-heavy code or doing if it's doing other types of operations, it's really hard to estimate. Okay, before we dive into the roofline model, we could also look at other types of models, for instance, analytical models or statistical performance models. Analytical models is something, for instance, the High Performance Computing Group, two stories up, is doing. They have developed very precise analytical models, which are based on the machine properties and the properties of code. So for instance, if we're doing stencil codes, they can very well predict how your code will be performing on a certain architecture. The problem is, to apply those analytical models, you have to know a lot about the hardware and your code. And on the other side, the roofline model only needs really basic knowledge of the hardware and your code. Statistical performance models are slightly different. For those, you usually use sampling. So you execute your code on a certain hardware and try to deduce from a certain number of samples how well it could execute on other hardware or how well it might run for different data sets. Usually those models are more precise than the roofline model, but also they need a lot of more expert knowledge. Okay, So, the roofline model. It's a simple two-dimensional model, and we assume there are two different types of bottlenecks. Main bottleneck is off-chip memory bandwidth. So how fast can I move data in and out? And the other limitation is my peak performance. And to characterize a code, we will just look at the operational intensity, which means how many floating point operations do I perform per byte moved. And what I get is basically a two-dimensional curve, which tells me for which operational intensity I can expect which performance. Now, I've been talking about kernels and intensity. So what this gives us is a brief overview how compute intense certain kernels are. So for instance, sparse matrix vector multiplications are very unintense, even sometimes yielding less than one floating point operation per byte move. If I have structured grids like usual stencil codes, they have a slightly increased operational intensity. Actually, there are algorithmic tricks by which I can increase the arithmetic intensity. And the code which we've been using for the exercise is also a stencil code, even though it's just a 1D stencil code. And one of the optimizations will be to use cache blocking to move its intensity way to the right. So other codes would be FFTs, which are slightly more intense. What's really intense is n-body codes, because there you have a lot of interactions. What this O of n or O of 1 means is basically with the problem size, the number of interactions or computations here is fixed, while, for instance, for n-body codes, it really grows with the number of other particles. So if you have, let's say, an n-body code with long-range interactions, and you have n particles, you would have to perform per particle n interactions per time step, which is why this is actually here on the far right. So what we would assume is that n-body particles achieve higher gigaflops counts compared to, let's say, sparse matrix vector multiplications. Okay. How do we derive the arithmetical intensity? Basically, we just look at the kernel and count the number of floating point operations, and we count how many bytes get moved. And this gives us a measure for the arithmetic intensity. And if we try to calculate how many gigaflops I can achieve, so again, we have the problem that flops is not clearly defined. Sometimes flops just means floating point operations. Sometimes it means floating point operations per second. But basically, the roofline model just tells us the attainable gigaflops is the minimum of the peak floating point performance or memory bandwidth multiplied by operational intensity. So for very low operational intensities, this term will be smaller. And if the operational intensity surpasses a certain limit, memory bandwidth is no longer a limiting factor, but in that case, peak performance of the chip is the limiting factor. Any questions for the roofline model in general? Okay, good. So here's a quick example. It's an older CPU. It's an Opteron X2 dual core running at 2 GHz. And what we can see here is here for an operational intensity of 1, we can achieve the peak floating point performance. And for lower intensities, the performance is limited by the memory throughput. How would the curve change if I increased memory bandwidth by a factor of 2? It's actually a trick question, because I hope you would make the same mistake as I did. I used to think that if I increase the memory bandwidth, then the slope of this curve should change. It should be steeper. Actually, that's wrong because this is a log scale on both axes. So the curve would not change its slope. It would simply move to the left. So if I had twice the memory bandwidth, this point would be here, and this cliff would start here. So the new slope would have the same slope, but it would simply move 1/4 to the left. OK. Now the question is, how do I get the memory bandwidth and how do I get the peak performance of my chip? Actually, this is easy. I can use a benchmark for both. One way is to use the steam benchmark. Another solution would be to use liquid. Liquid is, has any one of you ever used liquid? That's very good. Okay, liquid is used, is developed by the HPC computing group in-house. The main developer is Jan Treibig. And actually, it contains the stream benchmark. So there's no real reason to download the stream benchmark if you can also use the benchmark suite in liquid. So this is one way to determine the peak memory bandwidth. To determine the peak performance of a multi-core CPU, you could now simply take the number of cores, multiply that with the clock speed, and then take a look at how many calculations can a CPU do per clock cycle. But actually, this is a problem because, as I told you before, at least for the Haswell EP CPUs, some cores might clock lower if you're using certain instructions. So today, computing the peak performance is really hard, and you basically have to either run your own benchmark sets or you have to trust the vendor. But it's questionable how trustworthy a vendor is if his own income depends on those numbers. Also, one problem is if I have a multi-core CPU, multi-cores share the memory controller, usually. So you would assume that if I have multiple cores competing for memory bandwidth, then they will simply get less bandwidth than before. One interesting point here is, for modern designs, mostly a single core cannot saturate the memory bandwidth, the complete memory bandwidth. So a colleague of mine did some measurements recently because we were planning to procure a new system, and we knew that the whole chip had a memory bandwidth of about 60 gigabytes per second. So he did some single core and multi-core measurements, and the result was multiple cores could saturate the memory bandwidth, but a single core would just get about half of that. A single core would get just 30 gigabytes per second. For more cores, so for two cores, I think they could already saturate memory bandwidth, but then adding more cores just resulted in each core getting less bandwidth per core. Yeah, but those are two ways to arrive at the basic performance data, what we need for the roofline model. Okay, this is the curve for Opteron X2 compared with the Opteron X4. So this is actually, I think it's even a quad-core design. And for this, memory bandwidth did not increase, but we suddenly have more cores, so the peak performance has changed. Okay, so if I now know the curve for my CPU, I could try to alter the properties of my code. So one way would be to apply instruction level parallelism and SIMD. SIMD is what you've seen in the last exercises, to try to change how many floating point or operations can run in parallel. Also, this really depends on your kernel. You could try to reschedule computations so that you always have a good balance between floating point additions and floating point multiplications. Because if both can be done independent from each other but simultaneously, then those might go into different pipelines. Actually, for for modern CPUs, it might be even beneficial to try to express all your calculations as a form of fused multiply add, because that would go through the pipelines even better. But sometimes this is simply not possible. So actually, many codes are add limited. Many codes perform a lot of additions, and they would get the multiplications for free, but sometimes they just don't need those. Okay, another way for optimization, which we'll all see in the following exercises, is restructuring loop for unit strided access. So if you have vector registers, you might want to structure all accesses to sit on certain alignments, for instance, on cache line boundaries. You can also use software prefetching, which is not that much beneficial on Intel Xeon CPUs. It is very beneficial on the Xeon Phi or on IBM architectures. Okay. So what we've seen on the previous slides is if I increase the peak performance of a chip, I can alter the ceiling here. So if I'm counting just thread level parallelism, if I don't have instruction level parallelism, but just multiple cores, I would assume that the peak performance of a certain CPU might be this. But if I factor in instruction level parallelism or SIMD, or even both, I can arrive at higher levels of peak performance. It's really crucial to realistically assess the peak performance of a chip. So usually a hardware manufacturer will tell you this value, but if you do your own calculations, you might figure out that for your code you can only achieve this. Okay, simultaneously I can also figure out how to increase my memory bandwidth. So for instance, simple code might only achieve this bandwidth, but if I add memory affinity, does anyone know what memory affinity means? Let's assume I have a two-socket system. Each system has its own memory banks. Each socket has its own memory banks. The CPUs are usually, if you buy an Intel system, connected via QPI. And let's say one thread is running here. Which memory bank will it use if it reserves a certain memory, let's say via malloc, please?
Yeah, the one nearest to the CPU is running.
So okay. That would make sense. How is this determined?
The first touch on the memory determines where it resides.
Yeah. Very good. Okay. So at least for Linux, the default is if a CPU touches a memory, so for instance, because it's initializing it with zeros, the kernel will determine where to actually allocate the RAM. And mostly this is first touch policy means the RAM next to the core. You can also configure your CPU or your Linux kernel to use a different kind of placement. So you could also use interleaving, which means that the RAM assigned to a certain memory space will be half of this mixed. But this is usually not beneficial for high performance computing codes. So, question, what happens if the thread is allocating memory here, it is initializing it, so placement actually happens here, and then the thread gets scheduled here for execution by the operating system? That's really bad, because now the thread always has to go through the QPI bus to retrieve its data. What memory affinity means is the threads will be bound to the socket or to the NUMA domain where the memory is actually allocated. So that whatever happens to this thread, I really want to keep it within this CPU, at least within the socket, so it doesn't move away too far from the RAM it needs. Other measures to increase performance are to use software prefetching. And yes, if you have all these optimizations, you would arrive at the peak memory bandwidth realized by the stream benchmark. Actually, this implies that the stream benchmark is already well enough optimized. If you just Google for the stream benchmark, chances are you will download a slow copy of that, so some code which is not well optimized. If we put both together, we can see that there are actually different curves for the roofline model. If we only make naive assumptions about the memory throughput and the peak performance, we might assume that for a certain CPU, this is the actual curve. If we arrive at optimal values, we might actually get this curve and this peak floating point performance. So it's hard to arrive at this data, and I would always recommend to use a benchmark for the memory bandwidth and to look at the microarchitecture very carefully to assess the peak performance. Okay, for this example, we'll take a look at two... So this slide says we'll take a look at four architectures. I think the following slides just have data for two different architectures. But the actual hardware here doesn't matter too much. What's probably interesting is that we can see here the Opteron has four cores per socket. The interconnect between those is not QPI because that's the inter protocol, but a hypertransport. And we have approximately 10 gigabytes per second on the memory. Okay, so these are the properties of each hardware. You don't have to learn this by heart. I never ever ask performance questions in the exercises. And we have four different benchmarks. As you've seen on the slide on arithmetic intensity, we had different kernels. For instance, the sparse vector matrix multiplication, sparse matrix vector multiplication has a very low computational intensity. The Lattice-Boltzmann code has a slightly larger intensity. This usually used for computational fluid dynamics, so I'm not really sure why it is mentioned here for magnetohydrodynamics, but someone will know. The Stencer code has a slightly lower computational intensity. This is a multi-grid code. Actually, Lattice-Boltzmann is also a Stencer code, so the classification here is not very strict. And we have a 3D fast Fourier transform, which has, at least for our benchmarks, the highest computational intensity. Now what I can do is I can apply those benchmarks to my architecture and arrive at light speed estimates. So this graph tells me I cannot exceed a certain performance for each benchmark, and the red axis are the actual measurements. So this tells me the stencil did achieve the theoretical peak performance. These measurements are slightly below the theoretical peak, but that's probably okay because I can see that any optimization I might think of won't yield me much performance. So the primary rule, the primary benefit of the roofline model is for me to assess, should I optimize my code even further or can I stop now? The FFT code? Oh yeah, that's good. Okay. Yeah. I was actually fooled by the logarithmic scale. Yeah. So yes, it should mean that by optimization you could here achieve a speed up of 2. Yeah. I'm not sure if one could actually optimize it that far. Yeah. So actually, usually I tell students not to use logarithmic scales, at least for speedup diagrams. It might make sense for this, but you always have to be aware of the logarithmic scale. Yeah. It's easy to get fooled. Actually, during the last week, students had to do speedup plots for one of the codes during the competition. And the competition judges explicitly asked them for log scale plots. And they did complain to me because they said, you told us we shouldn't do log scale plots because they are confusing and actually they hide data. But they still had to do it because otherwise they would have deduced points for not using a log scale plot. Which was, I still don't know why the competition rules said this, but yeah, sometimes you have to play by the rules. Anyhow, so this is, here we have the results for previous wars for the first three benchmarks, and what was missing was the sparse vector matrix, sparse matrix vector multiplication. And, not sure what's on the next slides. Okay, so for some reason, the sparse matrix vector multiplication was not shown on the previous slide. Okay, so I could have shown you now all the results for all different architectures, but I think that would be slightly boring. What you can now compare is the performance achieved with the the basic code and with an improved code. But basically, this just tells us code optimization is beneficial. Doesn't tell us much more. This is an older slide of Intel's architectures. What's interesting here is Intel has actually, as a reply to a short time where AMD was leading the CPU market, Intel tried to change the way they redesign their CPUs so they get a steady performance increment. Back then, when AMD was selling its first Athlon processors, Intel had the problem that their next microarchitecture was still some years away, and also their next process shrink was still years away. So a couple of years, AMD was actually outperforming Intel CPUs. And Intel did not have anything to do. They couldn't just magically get a new manufacturing process, and their next microarchitecture, as I said, still took some time. So what they did was they changed the way they developed their chips to have a new microarchitecture, roughly, I think, every 3 years, and also to have a new process shrink roughly every every 3 years. Was it 3 years or was it less? Anyhow, sorry? It doesn't really matter. So basically what they do is every next architecture is either a tick or a tock step, where they say either we are introducing a new microarchitecture, but we keep the structure size of the process, or we are introducing a new process, but we keep the microarchitecture. This has two benefits. First of all, by interleaving those, they get a steady increment of performance. Simultaneously, complexity gets reduced because if they introduce a new process, they can at least build upon a tested and proven microarchitecture. And if they introduce a new microarchitecture, they can rely on a proven and tested process. If you try to do both simultaneously, that's getting very complicated, because if your new chip doesn't perform as expected, you don't really know, is the fault of the process or of the new architecture? Do you know how this continued after Sandy Bridge? What did come after Sandy Bridge? Right, Ivy Bridge. So Ivy Bridge was basically Sandy Bridge with a new manufacturing process. What came after Ivy Bridge? Haswell, exactly. So Haswell was a new microarchitecture. And after Haswell? Broadwell, exactly. So Broadwell is the newest chip you can buy. Usually Intel rolls out new chips for notebooks first, then for desktops, and afterwards for servers. What will be the successor of Broadwell? I think Skylake. Okay, and afterwards? Doesn't really matter now, okay. Was it Crystal Lake? Well, we'll see. Okay. How much time? Oh, we still got a lot of time, so maybe we will run out of slides before we run out of time. We will see. You might wonder why we are now taking a look at the Intel Nehalem architecture, even though we have much more advanced architectures from Intel. The reason is Nehalem was a huge step up for Intel, because they changed a lot of hardware properties which they kept in the following years. So one change was each core now has its own level 1 and level 2 cache. This is still true for the most recent architectures. Before that, before Nehalem, cores only had their own level 1 data cache, and level 2 cache was shared. Also, the memory controller got moved on die. Previously, it was on the main board. One reason why AMD was outperforming Intel years before was they had moved the memory controller on chip before, and this did cut some of the memory latencies. Also, they introduced QPI for connecting multiple sockets, and some Nehalems, not all. So, for instance, the server chips did not have GPU cores, but those targeted for notebooks did include their own GPU core. Oh, by the way, do you know what the largest manufacturer for graphics processing units is? Who's selling the most GPUs? Yeah, exactly, Intel. It's sort of a trick question, because actually, when I was asked this question first, I said, oh, that's clear, that's NVIDIA. And for PCI Express cards, this is true. Intel is IBM. NVIDIA is actually selling the most PCI Express cards for graphics processing, far more than AMD. And Intel is selling no PCI GPUs. But because almost every CPU Intel sells today to consumers does have an integrated GPU core, you can pretty much say Intel is leading this. I think it would be interesting to see if this is still true if you factor in smartphones, because smartphones also have a GPU core, and Intel is not very strong in this market. Yeah? Mostly not, which is sad, because for number crunching, those GPU cores might be interesting, and you can sometimes even program them via OpenCL. So I would be interested to see a server-grade Intel CPU which does feature this. They mostly have more cores and thus larger caches. But they don't have special execution units, not yet. If you order a new CPU from Intel, they won't give you any customized execution units. But if you order, I think, from 1 million CPUs on, Intel now offers to customize the die for you. You just need to have a couple hundred millions of US dollars, and then they will do this for you. So, for instance, as far as I know, Amazon has already ordered customized cores, and might make sense for other huge data center users. Yeah, sadly, our university doesn't have enough money, because I would be interested to see how much Intel would be willing to customize the die. So as far as I know, you could even ask for certain instructions within the core, or even certain execution units. But actually, I think they did not disclose too much data about which customizations they would allow. The interesting thing is, this is a basic plot of the Nehalem architecture or how its different cores are connected. And this is still true for even the most recent Haswell EP CPUs. What's changed is this is logically a shared level 3 cache, but as I said before, hardware-wise, actually, newer chips have partitioned this cache into smaller heaps, which are then connected via a ring bus, but still logically, it appears like one huge monolithic level 3 cache. One thing you have to notice about the level 3 cache is, because it's sitting on a ring bus, you might not access all data with the same speed, but sometimes you will have to pay in higher latency cost. What's also still true is we are still using QPI, even though a newer version, and we still have an integrated memory controller. Depending on the CPU, you might have less or more channels. Also, what's changed is the loop stream detector and actually also the instruction cache. On core 2 and before, this detector was directly after the instruction fetch phase, and now it is situated behind the decode phase, which means before it was operating on instructions, x86 instructions, now it's operating on micro instructions, which are basically RISC instructions. This has one benefit: RISC instructions are easier to handle. The downside is RISC instructions are also smaller, so we suddenly need more space for more instructions. This is one reason why the size went up from 18 to 28 microinstructions. One usual way to speed up a code is to use loop unrolling, because sometimes jumps will confuse the decoder. This is actually one reason why it's sometimes not beneficial to unroll loops, because in that case, the body of the loop increases in size, and if it's too long and exceeds the loop detector and the loop instruction cache, then it might fall out of this cache, and then the execution speed might degrade. Okay. One important improvement for the Nehalem architecture was also energy management. So the CPU itself can measure its own temperature. It can set the voltage of all cores individually, and can also adopt the clock cycle and voltage according to the requirements. This is new. Before that, I think at least for the Intel Core 2 CPUs, you could only set the voltage on a global level. Now, the downside of this is pretty much always the case. The more intelligent your CPU is, the more complex your control units are. This applies to single cores. If I have a more complex look-ahead logic, this I will have to pay for this with transistors. But it also applies to power regulation. So if I want to control power on a very fine-grained scale, this will cost me transistors. So, and this is a bit ironic, because more transistors also mean an increased power usage. Okay, so this is, I think, just basic marketing material from Intel. As I said before, turbo boost is an euphemistic way of saying that you can speed up clocks, certain cores, if you're just using a limited number of cores. But the other way of looking at this is to say, we don't have enough thermal design power to speed to run all cores on the maximum speed. Hyperthreading is Intel's marketing name for SMT, simultaneous multithreading. This is actually a feature present in many other manufacturers' CPUs. So it's present in IBM CPUs, it's present in Sun's older CPUs, it's present in Spark CPUs. There's only one manufacturer I would know that doesn't have SMT. Which would that be? Yeah, AMD, exactly. So, as far as I know, no AMD design does have simultaneous multithreading. I'm not sure why. I think they used to make fun of Intel's approach for some years, because they said, hey, we have real multi-core CPUs. But right now, at least in the high-performance computing scene, people are making fun of AMD's module approach, where they double the integer core but not the floating-point core. Okay, more marketing material from Intel. We'll just briefly skip through this. So if I have a single processor, and this tries to execute two threads, what it will do is it will interleave those in a time slice manner. And the result is that this might not be very efficient. But if I try to have still one physical processor which has a duplicated front end, so it can actually decode multiple instruction streams in parallel. The assumption is, well, sometimes I can leverage unused resources in my CPU to execute more instructions. Now, for high-performance computing, this usually does not yield too much of an increment in performance because of two reasons. Either my code is limited by memory bandwidth, but memory bandwidth will not increase via hyperthreading, or my code is limited by the peak floating point performance, and this also doesn't change for hyperthreading. So hyperthreading usually is just beneficial to codes which have a very specific irregular instruction mix. So or you have two different programs running simultaneously. One's doing a lot of integer calculations, for instance, a compiler, and the other one is doing a lot of floating point calculations, for instance, a simulation. So hyperthreading is good if you're doing, if you're recompiling your code while running it simultaneously, which probably everyone is doing all the time. So many high-performance computing centers actually switch off hyperthreading in the BIOS because it's just confusing users. I know of one legitimate use in high-performance computing, and this is MPI pacing. How many of you have used MPI before? Okay, you don't have to, because we'll do some of this in the lecture later on. So MPI is basically a library which allows you to pass data from one node to another without caring for the underlying network. And hopefully MPI will do this efficiently. There are different types of communication patterns in MPI, and one is asynchronous communication, or as MPI calls it, non-blocking communication. Actually, non-blocking communication is closer to the truth, because people usually assume if something is non-blocking, then they assume that in the time between initializing the communication and waiting for completion, MPI should have made some progress for the communication. But what actually happens is, if you initialize communication, MPI will say, okay, I'm working on this, but it won't do anything until you say, okay, now please notify me when you're finished. And then MPI will do all the communication and tell you, okay, now I'm done. This is the usual case. If you look more closely, what actually happens inside MPI is, if you're sending, let's say, 100 megabytes, what it will do first is it will send the first 1 kilobyte, depending on your hardware, maybe a bit more, maybe even less, and then won't do anything until you wait for the communication. But what happens if you ping MPI in between by calling some random function of MPI, it will then send the next chunk of data. So if you do this frequently, you can tell MPI to actually communicate asynchronously, but it's then your responsibility to not call MPI too often, because that would incur overhead, and you shouldn't call it too seldom, because then again you will send the majority of the data in the end. So what does this have to do with hyperthreading? If your main thread is doing all the computations and it's doing all the floating point computations, your other thread could be calling MPI. And MPI doesn't do much floating point calculations because it's just moving data, right? So the second call could then always wake up your InfiniBand hardware and ask it to send more data. It could control network devices and this. So that is one reason why sometimes it's beneficial to use hyperthreading, but this is very specific. So yeah, as I said, most codes don't really benefit from that yet, please. Yeah.
But I've never tried it myself.
Oh, that's interesting. But that means that... Okay, so that would mean that both threads have to be closely correlated to achieve this. Do you have a link for this, or could you point me to the paper? Okay, because that's interesting. I never heard of that. Because usually what happens if you try to synchronize multiple threads, the synchronization has to go through main memory, at least for many codes. So synchronizing multiple threads is actually costly. Okay, this is some non-descriptive benchmark. More marketing data from Intel. Okay, we know that this is probably to be expected, that Penryn, this was the predecessor to Nehalem, this had a inferior memory bandwidth compared to Nehalem. This is probably just to be expected. What's interesting, though, is that bandwidth does not scale linearly with the number of memory channels. So I don't get a 50% improvement for more memory channels. What is, though, interesting is that the latency increases with the number of channels. Okay, quick path interconnect, as I said before, is the connection between multiple sockets. It's the first time that Intel had a dedicated bus interface which can talk to other sockets and also to I/O chips. Actually, I think these two arrows here are not true any longer. Usually you'd put the I/O hardware just on one QPI bus and then ask the other socket to talk through QPI to the I/O hub. So for instance, if you look at the topology of a current server board and you try to see where each PCI device is connected to, it will be connected to either one socket or the other, never to both simultaneously. I just briefly, okay, so we are close to running out of time. It does not really make sense to try to rush through the remaining slides. So I would say thank you very much for being here, and see you next week. No, see you tomorrow, actually, for the exercises.